CityCast from Explicity.
As part of Siddhartha's awakening, he became aware of a spiritual energy in nature where trees had souls, birds had wisdom, and flowers bloomed no matter what the season, and snakes had the power of protection. And then there was all manner of mythical and hybrid creature contributing to the magical art and literature of Buddhism. In this captivating environment, Gautama, following his enlightenment, became known as the Buddha. People followed his teachings, and by, people embraced Buddhism as their guiding faith. For the thousands of years following the Buddha's passing in 400 BC, give or take, Buddhism has become an institution. And iconic to this institution are its monuments and relics. The most recognizable part of Buddhist architecture is the stupa, which is a domed structure that serves as a place of veneration, of meditation, and spiritual pursuit. Originally built to house and protect the Buddha's ashes, and later those of enlightened monks, the stupa houses Buddhist relics, relics that are central to the heritage and art of Buddhism. Of the many symbols and icons of Buddhism, there are two that are most easily identifiable. The tree. Everyone knows that the most remembered thing is that the Buddha came to his enlightenment under one, the Bodhi tree, and the other is the snake. Snake cults have always been known to India, as I guess there has always been the danger of snake bites, still an issue today in many parts of the country. But the snake features in the narrative of the Buddha's life. In one famous story, a cobra coiled itself around the base of Buddha's platform where he was meditating and the tree, and then spread its hood over its head to protect him from the elements as he reached his enlightenment. And ever since, understandably, the snake has been used as the principal symbol of protection. Happening right now in New York City as we speak is an exhibition called Tree and Serpent at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. It explores the origins of Buddhist art in India. The exhibition features more than 140 objects dating from 200 BC to 400 AD or CE, same thing, including sculptures, jewelry and metalwork, and it also explores the influences of early Buddhist art by other cultures such as the Hellenistic world and the Roman Empire. While the exhibition will only last a few months, the book, I don't know if I should call it a companion book, Tree and Serpent, will last in perpetuity. The most significant slice of it is that this exhibition focuses on the contribution of South India to the Buddhist canon. Historically, the contribution of South India was often overlooked or downplayed, and Tree and Serpent seeks to address, if not correct, this gap in the narrative. My guest today is John Guy. He is the author of Tree and Serpent, and he is Florence and Herbert Irving Curator of South and South Asian Art at the Met in New York. His scholarly association with Indian art spans a lifetime of work, and I am deeply honored to be able to speak with him today. What I find amazing is what he had to go through to put this exhibition together. From ferreting out these Buddhist relics in remote parts of Andhra and other locations, to shipping them to New York, the process must have been consuming. Amplify that when you consider some of the heaviest pieces had to be transported before the monsoon set in by a boat, a ferry across the Krishna River, and then by land, and then loaded onto planes at Hyderabad bound for New York. Let's ask him all about it. And now, here he is joining me from his office in New York City. John Guy, welcome to the Literary City.
Thank you, Ramji. A pleasure to be here.
Now, let's start by talking about the exhibition. In this interview, I might use exhibition and book interchangeably, but please correct me if I get something wrong.
Of course.
The scale of what you have put together is mind-boggling. From getting bureaucratic permissions to the sheer logistics of it all, couldn't have been easy.
What can I say? It was a long and protracted process, made longer, of course, by the interregnum of COVID, which knocked us off course for a couple of years. But having said that, the cooperation I've had on the ground, museums across India and in the ministries, I've been working with six state governments at secretariat level, in addition to central government of India, Ministry of Culture, National Museum, ASI, and so forth. So all the key players in the museum culture sphere in India. We borrowed in the end from over 12 sites across the country. So this was just logistically complicated, no question. And it could not have happened without that on-the-ground cooperation. So we're enormously indebted. I mean, we have works of art, some of which have not been seen outside India before, others not seen outside India for more than a generation. One or two, in fact, not seen in India, have come straight from the sites to the exhibition.
Many of the pieces in the exhibition are heavy stone carvings. I mean, they're not foam board, right? How heavy?
Yes, I sometimes jest that I made a serious mistake in my career choice, and I should have been a curator of works on paper. Made life much simpler and less backstrain. I don't personally lift the works, of course, but yes, we ended up with four shipments flying out from Delhi, four consignments, pelletized, large, heavy cargo consignments. Distribute over four flights to for weight distribution, so it was complicated and dare I say an expensive exercise. Professionally packed by the leading art handling company in India, everything arrived in pristine condition, it's been a seamless operation.
And did installing all that take you a long time?
It did take us 4 weeks to actually install the exhibition. That's kind of double the normal time for most exhibitions because the team of riggers, heavy lifting equipment, and so on, gantries, forklifts, team of people, very skilled and experienced in handling antiquities in this way, specialized art handlers. So all of those skills were brought into play. And of course, we had an excellent design team on realizing the concept for the exhibition, 3D design, the graphic design, all sort of integral to this, the lighting specialists. It's a very multi-faceted exercise. At any one time, we had between 25 and 30 people in the galleries during the installation process. All there with different sets of skills, from the people who work the steel to make the fixtures, to the carpenters, to the lighter, etc. Complicated process. A big investment on our part, of course.
I'd imagine. Now, getting them, flying them to New York in four planes is one thing, but getting them to the airport in Andhra, that must have been something of an exercise.
Well, yes. I mean, they came from so many different places. As I say, six states were participating. The cooperation of the government of Andhra Pradesh, Telangana, West Bengal, UP, Bihar, and Maharashtra. The works had to be collected from each of those places with a National Museum representative there, because they were the nodal institution for coordinating all of this. They did a wonderful, wonderful job, the hub of the wheel. Then with the art packers, the works then transported to the nearest airport, flight to Delhi. And then there's a review process to finally grant the permission for them to leave, get what's called a temporary export permit to leave for a temporary exhibition abroad, administered by a specialist committee.
Any challenges?
There were moments of stress, no question. Once we got things moving again after coming back, revisiting after COVID, it wasn't so much getting the final decisions. The goodwill was there. It was getting them in the right time frame in order to get those works on the plane so we had time to install them for a fixed opening date. That became a little bit stressful. We do global exhibitions all around the world. It's not the first time at all.
But those heavy pieces, you had to transport them over land, over water. And where was that, Nagarjunakonda?
Well, yeah, so the one particular site, it's an ASI museum. It's a wonderful museum, one of my favorites in the Deccan, at Nagarjunakonda. It's an island, a man-made island. It was a hill in the Krishna River system when the Nagarjuna Sagha was created in 1960. It was became an island, the tip of that particular hill.
Yes, that happened because of the dam,
yes.
Didn't it?
Creating the Great Reservoir when Prime Minister Nehru sought to introduce electrification to the Deccan, which was absolutely essential for development and so on. That they gave the Archaeological Survey, I think, 5 years to excavate and document, and then it was flooded. It's the ancient capital of the Ishvakuk kingdom, successors to the Satavahanas. So it was archaeologically, of course, a loss, but it was essential for development.
So it's still there, then, underwater.
Yeah, so the objects are on the museum on this, the tip of the hill, which is now an island. And they run a regular ferry service for visitors out there, except in the monsoon, of course. It closes down for several months. It gets quite choppy out there if there's a good, if you're got winds blowing. So it's a big stretch of water. So the works had to be, yes, we had to send the crate. They have pontoons to bring materials to the island. The crates were taken out, things were packed. Loaded on the pontoons and brought back to the mainland, and then the trucks took them to Hyderabad Airport.
Quite something.
So quite a logistical exercise.
You know, I have this rather dramatic notion of you standing at the prow of a rickety boat, which makes you the closest I'm going to get to meeting an Indiana Jones.
Right. Well, I wasn't there at that very moment, but I'd been there many times previously, including going out. There's an early boat. It goes 8 a.m. And that's for the security staff and the curatorial staff of the museum. So on occasions, because I know the staff there quite well, they say, you know, come for 8 o'clock, and we go, you know, so I go on the staff boat and then have a full working day, come back on 4 o'clock.
That's quite adaptable. I think you need your own moniker, India Jones.
India Jones, I like that.
So on page 208 of the book, there's a 1937 Archaeological Survey of India photo of the pieces. Now, those are massive artifacts. I'm assuming that's the same ones we're talking about. And they're made of limestone?
They are. I mean, the exhibition could have been called the Art of the Stupa, because almost everything in the exhibition, with a few notable exceptions, were part of the original adornment of stupas. Those big slabs you're referring to, which are massive, they're the size of a household door, and, you know, 6 to 8 inches thick limestone, very, very heavy, lined the drum of the stupa. So as you do the circumambulation as a pilgrim or devotee within the enclosure railing, the Vedika, with the stupa to your right as you progressed around three times, you could read the narratives on all these reliefs. And likewise on the pillars and crossbars of the enclosure railing. And if it was a rich enough stupa or monastery, then it would have elaborate gateways as well, taranas. So all of these were sort of venues for storytelling.
Right. Now, these slabs are made of limestone. 2,000 years and no disintegration?
Well, it depends on the conditions in which they had rested for, you know, 2,000 years. Mm-hmm. So some of the material, there's a significant amount of material from Barhud, and one item from Sanchi. They're in sandstone. But the bulk of the material that we concentrated on the exhibition, and which I wanted to celebrate, really was the achievements of what I call Southern Buddhism, Southeast, really. I mean, the Satavahanas, the Krishna Godavari River system, network of what must have been, you know, ancient trade routes along which are scattered the monasteries. And the predominant stone there is a beautiful milky white limestone.
Now, on the subject of the contribution from the south, which is something that you mentioned in your foreword to the book about correcting the narrative, was it a conscious decision for you to do that and not do an exhibition about Buddhist art in India, top to bottom?
Well, yes, it was a very, very much a conscious decision not to do an A to Z of Indian art, or A to Z of Buddhist art, Mathura, Sarnath, Pala, Bodh Gaya, a little side trip up to Peshawar Valley and for Gandhara in Pakistan. That's been done many times and is important and of course, central to the narrative of early Buddhist art. The Buddha never went south. Right. But of course, within a very short time, his relics did. And, so his presence was felt there very early. It's not to deny the existing history, which is very much interwoven with the Shungas and the Kushanas. But there's another parallel story here, which is the Buddhist culture under the Satavahanas and the Visvakas, the two great southern Indian dynasties from around, you know, 1st BC to around 4th century Common Era. This is equally important. And in terms of the monuments that survive, it deserves more than a footnote, what it often gets.
Right.
And one way of demonstrating this is simply to say, think of the four great early monuments of Buddhist art in India, full stop, and you can recite Bahut, Sanchi, Ajanta, Amaravati. All in the south.
Wow.
India's global position at that time, early centuries of the Common Era, it wasn't the Kushanas who were controlling all the Roman trade, it was the Satavahanas from the Konkan coast and the west coast of India, and also the Bay of Bengal trade for gold from Southeast Asia and so on. So, they were extremely well connected, and of course, the wealth was built on the back of Buddhism. Really, was built on the trade wealth from the merchant communities, from the artisan guild communities, who were prosperous. You know, growth of towns and cities and so on along these trade routes, and the monasteries are part of that story.
Right. I find it fascinating when archaeological finds unearth stories about cross-border and cross-cultural trade, which brings me to my question about two artifacts that are highlighted in the exhibition. First, the ivory yakshi that was discovered in Pompeii. You wrote that it dated back to the 1st century CE. So the destruction of Pompeii was in 79 CE, so around then?
No, so she's pre-79, right. Yes.
So which absolutely. Means that it landed up over there in Pompeii before that, and it was excavated from the ashes, the rubble.
Yes, yes. She was in what's been identified from other artifacts as probably a merchant's house.
Right.
So she was probably part of his inventory of things he'd imported, probably quite recently, and hadn't yet sold. She probably didn't arrive that much before 79, and it was destined for someone's collection.
It's amazing. And soon after that, as you said, in 1944, was the discovery of the bronze statue of Poseidon, wasn't it?
Correct.
In Kolhapur.
That's right. There's a site called Brahmapuri, which is in modern-day on the banks of the river of Kolhapur, which is a little inland, but on the west coast, not far from Pune.
Right, right. So is there any notion as to how old that statue may have been?
Well, there's discussion about that in Roman studies circles. I mean, most people think he's probably 2nd century Common Era, probably made in Alexandria. It's a small thing. It's only 4 inches in height, but it's a direct replica, if you like, of a monumental ancient Greek sculpture of Poseidon, which was lost in antiquity, no doubt melted down in some war, it's been long gone. But these continued to be made, and the images of this size were essentially for household shrines, just as we have miniature images, in Brahmanical little folk bronzes and so on for the puja room or the shrine in the corner of a living space.
Right, just like someone gave me a little leaning tower of Pisa, a tourist souvenir, tchotchke. But this representation of Poseidon originally would have had a trident, correct? You can tell from the posture.
Yes, yes, absolutely. He's in the posture. He's one foot raised on a rocky outcrop and raised hand to hold the trident, which is no longer there. It would have rusted away, I guess.
I'd imagine, And so you point out that this was the principle. I mean, these two are evidence of the trade that existed between the Romans and the Satavahana kings. Now, those guys were basically Shaivite kings. But there's enough evidence to show that they actively extended their patronage to Buddhism, isn't there?
Well, absolutely. We see this right through history. You see, with the Cholas in the medieval period in the south, the devout Shaivas, and they had one eye, of course, on the economy and prosperity of their kingdom, and the people running the much of the international trade through Nagapattinam, you know, in the medieval period, and these west coast ports, Sopara and others near in the Bombay area, were Buddhists and Jains, and so you know these tolerance was very much part of this, and it wasn't. What we do find, we have a lot of knowledge, in fact, about the patronage system of Buddhist monuments, because these monuments are built of all these component parts, and often someone would just fund one pillar or one crossbar.
Right.
It's like buying a seat in the opera, name on the back of the plaque on the seat.
Yes,
so it's a communal investment in their spiritual welfare. What's interesting is a vast majority of those are lay people.
That's interesting.
Business people, tradespeople, ivory guild, mm-hmm. Practice members, and so on. Predominantly women, mm-hmm. Describe herself as the wife of a, what they call Ganapati. It's a sort of man of prosperity, man of property.
Right.
You know, some debate about what it precisely refers to, and then women of royal households under the Ashvakas at Nagarjunakonda. The women of the royal household were very active patrons of Buddhism, even though you know their husbands and fathers were Shaiva.
Hmm. Such a pity that the whole business of patronage for the arts is sort of crumbling, isn't it?
Yes, we all need a Medici, don't we?
Yes, we do.
I mean, the kings are there as well. And we mustn't forget, you know, Ashoka, of course, and then the great West Gateway at Barhut, which is now reconstructed in the Indian Museum in Calcutta so beautifully. That's directly linked to a member of the Shunga clan, probably a first cousin of the king or some sort of relationship like that. We don't know precisely. Not the king himself, but probably one of the princes.
I'd like to move on now to that part of your book that spoke about the representation of the Buddha in Buddhist art. On page 17 is your first reference to an iconic art. That is, the Buddha was not represented in a bodily form, but rather symbolically, right up to the 3rd century AD. Why was this? Was it frowned upon?
Well, we don't know precise reasons why the Buddha didn't appear in human form until much, much later. The archaeological record makes it very clear that there was a reluctance or refusal to represent him in anything other than symbolic ways.
And what were the best known symbols?
The Buddhapada, the footprints. Mm-hmm. You have the Dhammacakra over the wheel for the teachings, the riderless horse for the departure renunciation scene, and so on. And of course, you know, then the stupa itself, you know, sometimes with relics depicted on display, which is something the texts don't tell us so much about. That relics, what we always think of as relics concealed within the solid core of a stupa. But in addition to that, relics were also then kept for periodic display during festivals, paraded and so on. And we get glimpses of this by about the 5th century. Chinese pilgrim accounts make reference to this for the first written accounts we have.
An iconic art is not peculiar to Buddhism. It's well known in many religions and cultures around the world, Islam, for example. But in the case of the Buddhists, the Buddhists don't claim that the Buddha was anything other than a man, a human being, and not a deity. So I return to my earlier question as to why was there such an unwillingness to portray him in a human form?
Well, we don't honestly know the answer, but I think it's probably a wider debate that was going on that went beyond just Buddhism. And even in early Brahmanical thinking, can a mere mortal presume to imagine what the divine looks like? It's beyond comprehension. Mm-hmm. In Shaivism, you know, we end up with the linga as a conceptual representation,
right.
In no sense literal. It's an abstract concept. So it's I think that's part of that wider wider thinking that was going on at that time. And of course, the Buddha was a reformer. I mean, he was, I often think of him as the Martin Luther of India. I mean, reacting against the priesthood and so on,
yes,
trying to step outside.
He
was radical in that sense. But yes, he was never deified. And what we see in the exhibition is by the very end of the exhibition, when you get the sort of these fully realized Buddha images appearing, then something has been a shift. And really, he really is becoming an icon. And of course, the way in which worshippers react to that it gets very close to being deified.
Oh, is that how the exhibition is structured? It makes a lot of sense.
It is.
What a pity I'm going to be missing the exhibition. I'm never going to make it to New York by then.
I hope you can.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to. Now, from then till now, the depictions of the Buddha have changed so much over the years, from the Greco-Roman statuesque style to how he has been depicted in China, for example, like the fat and jolly Santa Claus of Beijing, if you like. So what changed? Why did they suddenly decide that they could represent him in anthropomorphic form?
Well, I mean, we don't know, and that's a fundamental debate that continues to roll on in historical circles. One thought on that is that it may come down to the simple word of competition. Early first millennium already, but very much so by the mid first millennium, common era, Brahmanism has really, you know, reaching out for a popular following, reading, memorizing all the Vedas and so on, introspective, you know, doing their Agni Pujas, but also bringing in the wider populace, in the sense of the beginnings of bhakti, if you like.
Yeah, bhakti.
This could well have been the trigger to say, oh, we need to make our teachings, our beliefs more accessible to people. It's a little abstract for the layman. And I think, you know, of course, Buddhism sort of was already losing momentum by the mid-first millennium.
Yes.
And by the end of the first millennium, it was really on its knees. Spent force in India, with a few exceptions, but largely speaking, it had run out of steam by then. What was happening, of course, was a great surge in popular Hinduism.
So on this related subject, let's talk about the Emperor Ashoka, who had a rather aggressive proselytizing campaign for Buddhism. Don't you think that he might have needed some iconography, like an image of Buddha, or were symbols sufficient for him?
I don't think he was setting the iconographic program. I mean, I'm sure he was, you know, made a significant input into the content of the inscriptions. We can read those in a sense as his voice, official and, you know, sanitized, but, you know, nonetheless, his voice is there. What, of course, he did was, by opening, as we're told, you know, he opened the eight original stupas that house the eight portions of the Buddha's corporeal remains, distributed after the cremation, opened those, retrieved the relics, subdivided them multiple times, and distributed them, and really, in a sense, the sort of markers of the Mayan, his territory at that time, and it's very extensive.
This is so fascinating. As is your book, I lost the better part of 1 week completely immersed in it, Tree and Serpent.
No, just say I'm delighted to hear that. I mean, there's so much wonderful Buddhist art being produced in the Deccan that has largely been overlooked. And so this exhibition is both to share that with people but also float some ideas in terms of revisiting some of our understanding of early Buddhist art history and to celebrate so many sites and collections that are not so well known outside the northern Buddhist circuit.
Right, that's true. Okay, let's find out a little bit more about you. You worked for many years as the curator of the Victoria and Albert Museum in London.
Yes, a wonderfully eclectic museum. It has bits of everything. In the early 20th century, when they were trying to rationalize their collections in London, you know, the British Museum essentially is antiquities, and the V&A was everything else, except paintings, which were the National Gallery. So I had the privilege of working there for 22 years. It was a great experience.
And what led you to focus on India as a career choice?
Oh, well, I sort of trained as a medievalist, actually, and fascinated by Buddhism and Hinduism as well. The urge to travel quite early, the opportunities to do that, you know, second-class reserve trains, buses, you know, backpacking travel in my youth. And of course, wonderful experiences that remain with you all your life. You learn so much from those moments. So I've had a very privileged and charmed career.
And what does someone in your profession do? I mean, you guys don't stop, do you?
Well, afraid not. No, my family complained about that. It's one's sort of deeply engaged in this. It's embedded in one's DNA, I think.
I suppose so. And do you know what your next project will be?
Oh, I need to catch my breath a little, I think, before I venture. Some ideas are already swimming around my head, yes.
Well, you need to dust off the fedora and whip and get going, I guess.
Indeed.
Well, this was one of the most enjoyable conversations I've had. John Guy, thank you so much for being my guest today on The Literary City.
Thank you, Ramji. I'm delighted to have been here, and thank you for your stimulating questions. See you in Bangalore.
The gentleman that I have been speaking to for the last half an hour is John Guy. He is the author of Tree and Serpent, and there's a link in the podcast description to where you can buy a copy of that book for yourself and another to gift to another person. Trust me, it's worth it. And for my listeners in the United States, there's a link to where you can find out more about the exhibition. If you can visit it, do. It would be such a shame to miss it. And I'll be back with that fun segment, What's That Word?, where we look at words and phrases that we use all the time but never stop to think about, right after this. I'm back. It's What's That Word? And this is my co-host.
Hello. My name is Pranati, but you can call me P. That's P with an A, not another E.
And hello, P with an A. Hey, have you finished the book that you've been reading?
Which one?
Oh, you know that pulp thing? The one about the beekeeper who murders all the men in his town so that he can marry their wives?
What? I'm not reading any such book.
No, of course you aren't.
Oh, okay. So what's the name of the book I am reading then about this murderous beekeeper?
The Sting?
I see what you're doing. Okay, you had me there. Well, but let's forget all that. Let's talk about the interview with John Guy.
Well, I take it you had fun listening in the studio.
Yes, I did. You know, the point being that I would never in a million years have figured out how much excitement and drama goes on behind the scenes of an exhibition on Buddhist art.
Yeah, there's so much there. So much cross-border intrigue, isn't there?
Yeah, and thank you for making this so exciting. You know, initially I was nervous it would be a pedagogic episode on the turn of millennium, Buddhist art, and blah, blah. But by the end of it, I was nervous they were going to drop the art.
Yeah, what's an exhibition without a little slapstick, right? Well, anyway, that's how we roll. Really, the exciting stuff is all what John did, isn't it?
Yeah, and he sounds great. But wait, what did you call him again? Indiana Jones.
That's how he's going to the Met's next cosplay theme party.
Yeah, and you refer to it as his moniker.
Yes, I did, moniker. Is that where we're going today? Is that, what's that word?
Yes, today's word is moniker.
I like that word. Okay, you know the meaning, of course.
Yeah, I know what everyone knows. That it means a descriptive name or a nickname, right? As some say, appellation.
Correct.
But I guess the word is more nuanced than that. So let's get into the etymology, please.
Sure. And there's a lot of debate on this particular word.
Okay. So is it an interesting word?
Interesting enough. Now, the origins of moniker are somewhat murky, but I do know of some suggested origins.
Why murky? Because there's no evidence.
It's true. Like many words, this one has very, very little evidence. There's so many words like that, more than we like. You know, some words and phrases come into regular parlance, and they don't derive from a convenient textbook source, but rather something that is modified or even bastardized in its use over the years.
Right. So moniker is one of them?
Yeah, totally. And, you know, for example, some etymologists say that it's a mid-19th century hobo, you know, like hobo term that got turned from the word monk.
Monk?
Well, it is said that monks and nuns take new names or monikers with their vows. And in the early 19th century, British tramps or hobos refer to themselves as being in the monkery, which led to moniker.
And do you believe this?
No, not in the least. But another more romantic theory is that moniker originated from the Shelta language, and that was the secret language used by Irish travelers. Now, in Shelta, Mona Yen means name, and it's possible that that word got adopted into English slang as moniker.
So does the name Moynihan have the same root?
First thing I checked, and yes, it does.
So the dude's last name is Moniker.
There are many famous Moynihans, and yes, their last name means name. What a compromise to live with.
So, is there any more off-roading on this word?
Lots. The slang dictionaries, and there are many, all have fun with this word, which I guess is how etymologists get their jollies. But the Kessel Dictionary of Slang has 14 spellings for moniker, like that's the most important word that they should spend money on. And the Sydney Slang Dictionary from Australia, published in 1881, includes the word moniker, which means that word came into existence even before. And the mothership of slangwedge, Eric Partridge's Dictionary of Slang and Unconventional English, has a bunch of them.
Ah, and no one can agree on anything?
No, but the question is moot in this case. There are tons of other theories, such as Monica comes from the saintly name Monica. And that's a little facile, isn't it? And
yeah.
Some have linked the origin to Italian words, theories.
Any other absurd sounding ones?
Absurd, yeah. Well, one of them suggests that moniker is a compound of monogram and signature.
Well, interesting, all of them.
So which one's your favorite?
I like the Shelta one because, you know, it's a secret language of travelers. So intriguing.
Whoever the romantic, but, you know, that would be my pick too because it's the most plausible. And the tramp theory worked in that case too, because Shelta was also the secret language of the gypsies.
Ah, all this is very interesting. But before we go, earlier, you said slanguage?
Yeah, slanguage. It's a portmanteau word.
I love it. Slang plus language. Slanguage.
Well, here's another fun portmanteau. It's B plus I.
I know this one. Bye.
Let's go!
And that is our show. I'd like to thank my guest, John Guy, and my co-host, Pranathi P with an A, Madhav, and all of you for listening and those wonderful comments. Till next time, have fun. Catch you soon. Bye.